Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Europlex podcast with me, Gabriel Hedengren, and Javid Ibad. Hi, Javid.
Hi, Gabriel. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm here in a windy London, and I believe you're in my home country of Sweden recording this episode.
Exactly, and I'm in windy Malmö at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like all of Europe, we had a glimpse of spring or even summer, and then it's just gone back to being windy and cold. But let's not focus on that now. We have an extreme amount of news and upcoming elections and events to go through, don't we, Javid? So I think we're just going to go straight into it because there's so much stuff there. I think I'm going to start right away just by updating everyone on Portugal. So we spoke about the elections there and the tricky parliamentary outcome of those. It has now been confirmed, which is what we thought would happen, that Luis Montenegro from the centre-right Democratic Alliance has been sworn in as Prime Minister of Portugal. That happened on the 2nd of April. He replaced António Costa, who at that time was caretaker Prime Minister. What we now have is Montenegro leading a minority government, relying on the Socialist Party to pass legislation, as he still has promised not to work with the right-wing populist Chega party in parliament. So this is a unique situation for Portugal, with the two main parties collaborating with the centre-right in government. So they have also agreed, after a lot of back and forth, for a speaker of the parliament, also coming from the Democratic Alliance. His name is José Aguiar Branco, and he will be succeeded by a socialist candidate after 2 years. It's actually quite interesting. There are a few things throughout this episode of this being actually more and more common, of sort of alliances deciding to shift within an electoral period. So here's the first example of that between the centre-right and the centre-left in Portugal. It did come after a lot of failed votes in the parliament, lots of debates back and forth. So while it is sort of a victory and it shows that they can work together, you know, it also shows that there is a lot of possibility for disruption and gridlock going forward between these two parties. In terms of Montenegro's profile, he very much wants to portray this, you know, still as political change from the old government, which I guess it is, given he's the new leader. He has a centre-right sort of profile focused on lower taxation, especially for the middle class, very sort of business-focused. Portugal has a brain drain issue, meaning a lot of young professionals and educated young people leave the country. He wants to reform the public services. And also a big issue in the election was around the housing crisis. So that will be something he has to respond to as well as anti-corruption and pro-transparency plans following the previous government's various scandals. While there has been an agreement on the overall program between the two parties, the first sort of pay point will be the budget, because the new socialist leader, Pedro Nuno Santos, has said that the party will not vote for the budget, but sort of break out certain things that they will support in parliament. Interestingly, 32 out of 60 measures in the government's sort of proposed program for the next 4 years have been lifted directly out of the Socialist Party's election manifesto. So they are really trying to find a way in which having a stable government despite these circumstances. Beyond that, there are also measures in the program pulled directly from basically all the other parties' manifestos, and that includes far-right Chega that I mentioned, but all the way on the other side to also the Communist Party as well. It has been approved by Parliament after a two-day debate, so that will be seen as sort of a first victory for Montenegro and his government. Another interesting thing to point out is that a lot of MEPs from the European Parliament are part of the cabinet, 4 out of 17. So that obviously signals that the government will continue to be very pro-European. And I guess it's also a signal for the European parliamentary elections in June that there'll be change there as well in terms of Portuguese representation. So, you know, European standards, relatively quick resolution to the gridlock in Portugal. And yeah, it'll be up to the test now to see whether Montenegro can remain in post and govern effectively. But big news in terms of European politics. And there have been other changes at the head of state, head of government level, Javid.
In the previous episode, we talked about the Slovak presidential elections in the first round. We discussed the first round, but we couldn't the second one. We were saying that while Ivan Korčok, the former diplomat who was the ambassador to the EU and the US in the first round, we said that it still would be problematic for him to win the election the second round because there were other candidates. For example, the third candidate, Stefan Harabin, was 11%, who endorsed Peter Pellegrini, the other one. What we were suspecting ended up being the case because in the second round, Peter Pellegrini won the election with 53%, while Ivan Korčok had 46, almost 47%. What was interesting in this election is that the second round had a higher turnout than the first one. Compared to the second round of the previous presidential election, this second round had almost a 20% higher turnout, which is actually commendable. Which also brings us to the point that choosing Pellegrini was important for some part of the Slovak electorate, because Slovak electorate just wanted some stability, and it is believed, it's also widely reported in the media, that the Slovak electorate is tired and they have the fatigue from the Russia-Ukrainian war, and the pledges of Pellegrini to stop supporting Ukraine kind of appeal to the some of the electorate to tilt the vote to his favor. So as a result, Pellegrini will be sworn in as a president on June the 15th.
A big change as well, and I guess a strong message from the Slovak electorate, like you say. In Ireland, really quickly, we talked about this at a bit more length in our last episode as well, but it was later confirmed officially that Simon Harris of the centre-right Fine Gael is now formally elected as the leader of the party and therefore elevated to the position of Taoiseach, which is the equivalent of their prime minister, head of government, replacing Leo Varadkar following his resignation. This happened earlier in April and was approved by the Irish Parliament, or the Dáil. So lots of change this spring. It remains to be seen how much of a change it actually is, more sort of formally and in terms of policy, but I guess a new name and face for everyone to get used to. He is, I guess, excitingly also, just like Varadkar was when he came in, you know, quite young and progressive seeming, particularly for a centre-right politician. So I think in general, to be more informal, the vibes of the Irish sort of government will remain relatively similar until the next election. There's also been change and a resignation in Iceland, where Katrin Jakobsdottir from the Left Green movement resigned from her position as prime minister earlier in April. But this wasn't sort of retire, but actually to run for president in the elections that are being held for that position in Iceland at the beginning of June. So she's going for that more sort of ceremonial role. She's being replaced by a former prime minister of Iceland, Bjarni Benediktsson, who is from the centre-right Independence Party. This was agreed by the three-party coalition government. Iceland has quite a unique coalition in government between the centre-right, also including this more sort of not even social democratic, but more left-wing Green Party movement that Jakobsdottir comes from. But they agreed for Benediktsson to succeed in the role. And obviously, as part of that, there was a big renegotiation of the whole cabinet and so forth. Benediktsson has been Minister of Foreign Affairs up until now, so he's well known to people in Iceland and has a long track record in politics there, particularly, which I guess is interesting, that he still managed to nab this new job off the back of quite a lot of scandals. He breached COVID rules. He's been involved in one of the companies named in the Panama Papers. His father, who's big in the judiciary system in Iceland, there was a scandal around him and how he pardoned a convicted child sex offender. He also had to resign as finance minister before, because that was another role he had, after it was deemed that he wasn't qualified to handle the privatization of an Icelandic bank. So a controversial new prime minister for Iceland. So that might be more of an actual change than what we've seen in Ireland. But I guess interesting to see those changes at the top of government, not directly tied to electoral results. But I guess we'll report back on whether Katrin Jakobsdottir made the right decision or not by running for president in the next episode, hopefully, or the one after that. And now Turkey, which is very exciting, David.
Turkey had probably one of the most intriguing and interesting electoral developments in recent times, at least here in Europe. So when the local elections were approaching, a lot of observers, journalists, and even scholars were not really expecting anything big from the elections. And it was even believed that the current tide that Erdogan got, the legitimacy that he gained in 2023, will continue its way. But apparently that ended up not being the case at all, because on 31st of March 2024, Turks went to vote in local elections, which were widely seen as a victory for the opposition parties and a loss for Erdogan's Conservatives, Justice and Development Party. These elections had been held just 10 months after Erdogan's re-election as president of Turkey. And currently, Turkey has a very high inflation rate, nearly 70%, and Turks are currently experiencing tight monetary policy to bring the inflation down. The Republican People's Party, or CHP, gained the control of 14 new provinces in this election and now controls 35 out of 81 provinces of the country by winning nearly 38% of the vote. And CHP became the first party in Turkey in any election for the first time since 1977. And all five of Turkey's largest cities are now controlled by CHP, which are Istanbul, Ankara, Izmir, Bursa, and Adana. Meanwhile, AK Party now controls only 24 provinces by losing 15 of them and by gaining the 35% of the vote share. And for the first time ever since its inception in 2001, AKP could not become a first in any election. CHP candidate Mansur Yavaş from Ankara was re-elected with 60% of the vote compared to 51% in 2019. While Ekrem İmamoğlu, who's the mayor of Istanbul, he won 51% of the vote in Istanbul and got re-elected again. And he was already been elected twice in 2019. Why twice? Because after the first election where he was winning with a margin of 0.2%, the AK challenged the results, which leading to the election results being cancelled by the Supreme Electoral Council. And in the second election, he won it by 9% margin. İmamoğlu also has been on trial since January 2022 for insulting the electoral officials that cancelled the first Istanbul mayoral election. He has been sentenced to over 2 years in prison and banned from standing in any Turkish election. However, this judgment has not taken effect yet as it goes through the Turkish court system. And the ruling obviously has been criticized both domestically and internationally. But apart from that, not only they won the mayorship of Istanbul and Ankara, but they also won in the majority of districts of Istanbul and Ankara, which means that they also got the control of their respective municipal councils by increasing their power significantly. But there are also interesting developments happening in the conservative front. So a new emerging political force, the New Welfare Party, they won 6% of the vote and a control of two provinces. It is an Islamist party that had initially supported Erdogan in 2023 elections, but right now it's critical of Erdogan, especially because of its handling of Israel-Gaza conflict, and they want Turkish government to completely embargo Israel. It should be noted that the party is created to Fatih Erbakan, whose father, Necmettin Erbakan, was the chair of the Welfare Party, where Erdogan started his political career back in the 90s. The pro-Kurdish minority DEM party won 10 provinces with nearly 6% of the vote and gaining two more provinces. And meanwhile, the far-right nationalist movement party, which supports the minority AK government in parliament, won 8 provinces and 5% of the vote by losing control of 3 provinces. The Good Party, which was a breakaway from the Nationalist Movement Party, they only won control of 1 council. However, the party leader Meral Akşener announced her resignation because the party was underperforming vastly. And because after the opposition failed to defeat Erdogan, she pledged to contest elections independently. by splitting the anti-Erdogan vote, which was not met well by some part of the liberal Turkish electorate. The Turkish election authority tried to overturn an election result in Van, which is in the southeast of Turkey, where a Dem candidate Abdullah Zeydan was elected as mayor with 55% of the vote. The Supreme Electoral Board claimed that the candidate was ineligible to run because of previous convictions and gave the mayoralty to the second place AKP candidate, which had 27% of the vote. The ruling triggered protests in the province, and ultimately the decision was reversed on an appeal and after the protests, and he is now reinstated as the mayor of Van. All in all, the Turkish political sphere is galvanized once more, and it's going to be really interesting to observe how it goes until the general election of 2028, because there are no more elections in Turkey for the upcoming 4 years.
Yeah, I think it was really like a big surprise or a shock to lots of people, I guess, especially people that don't follow Turkish society and politics so closely. I think it'll be interesting to see how it impacts Erdogan's behavior and image, because I think, you know, everyone had this idea that he was sort of a bit invincible. He managed to squeeze through the last election. He was sort of grouped in with other world leaders like Modi, Orban, that, you know, whatever they do, they'll manage to cling on to power fairly unfairly. And now there's a bit of a sense around him that, you know, he's vulnerable. He's not as popular as he'd like to paint himself as. So I think it's very, very interesting to see what his response will be to this and like the part AKP's response. I agree with what you said at the start, that I think it's definitely the election result so far this year that, you know, is the most impactful or has the potential to have the biggest sort of waves.
It already has an impact, just like one brief detail. So Erdogan actually was planning after the election to introduce some constitutional amendments, which is believed so that he can run again to become a president in 28. But now these plans are somehow reversed, at least for some time, for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and I guess it's also interesting, I guess, the Erdogan as an individual leader versus his party, because in this case, obviously, there are other candidates, you know, local party officials and that kind of thing. So I'm sure lots of people will have been told off. It would have been a very disappointing night for him. And other elections that have happened, so going back to the national level, is in Croatia. So just a few days ago from when we record this, Croatian voters went out to elect their national parliament. So the backdrop of the elections was that the sort of emboldened or relatively successful opposition in Croatia, which is to the center left, took a big blow when politician called Zoran Milanovic was barred from standing for prime minister by the constitutional court in Croatia. So this was something that hurt them in the campaign. And despite losing some ground, the incumbent center-right Croatian Democratic Union party managed to cling on to power, you know, as part of being the largest group in parliament there. So in the end, the outcome was relatively small shifts in seats, with the opposition gaining a few seats, but the government still looking to cling on to power. Although it doesn't have a majority, so it's having to deal with a lot of minority, smaller parties in parliament, including a party called Homeland Movement, which is part of the Identity and Democracy group at the European Parliament level, so very much to the right. A party called MOST from the ECR group, so also to the right of the government. There are also lots of national minority MPs in Croatia that might be possible collaborators with the government as well. However, there are a lot of different disagreements in different ways between all these parties, as you can imagine. For example, the Homeland Movement dislikes the Serb minority party SDSS, but, you know, it looks quite likely that the government will be able to get some sort of coalition from the results. Centre-left Rivers of Justice, as I said, I guess they come out of it okay, but it'll be a big disappointment for them. And I guess in general for the sort of centre-left in the Balkans. And Javid, there is a lot of other activity in that part of Europe in terms of elections coming up, right?
Yeah, the Balkans are pretty hot when it comes to elections these days. So this spring, And to be precise, on April 24, North Macedonians are going to the poll. Firstly, they are going to the poll for a first round of the presidential election, and then on May the 8th, they're going to elect both the parliament and a potential second round of the presidential election. Well, the presidential election looks like it will be a rematch of the last time, with the Social Democratic candidates Devo Pendarovski and the nationalist right-wing VMRO. So there's a party called Internal Macedonian Revolutionary Organization - Democratic Party for Macedonian Unity. It's a really long name, so usually we just call it VMRO. So the VMRO candidate Gordana Siljanovska. In 2019, Pendarovski won the election with 53.5% of the vote, while Siljanovska got the rest for the 6.5%. So this time as well, it seems that there will be a runoff between them two. As for the parliament, there are four big tent coalition. Two of them are the Macedonian ones, one center of the left, the other is center of the right, and the other two coalitions are represented by the Albanian communities of Macedonia. Again, one a bit to the left and the other a bit to the right. So among like other parties, for example, the left party, Levice, is set to make gains in this election, but is facing competition from another left nationalist party, ZNAM, which is led by the mayor of Kumanovo. The mayor of Skopje is running her own party, but was not able to register to run in every district for the parliamentary elections, and that's why she decided not to nominate a candidate for the president for some reason. And the Alliance of Albanians, one of the Albanian parties, they had a court case to resolve the leadership dispute, which resulted in some sort of an internal division. And half of the party is in one Albanian coalition, and the other half of the party is in another. The stakes are of the election are the constitutional amendments to facilitate EU integration, as currently the Bulgarian minority is not recognized by North Macedonia, leading to tension with Bulgaria and stalling of their EU negotiations. And speaking of Bulgaria, now the turn is to you, Gabriel.
Yes, that was a good segue, but I just have to also say that it's not a specialty area of mine in any way, but it is fascinating to me in a lot of the Balkan countries, like this sort of big tent, massive coalition list system that literally for every election you need to sit down and study who's
Exactly.
gone with who, what party is what. Like, it's very different from the UK where I live, or lots of Scandinavia, where if you have one party that come up every 4, 5, 6 years, that's a massive deal. Whereas here it's just court cases, new parties, splits. It's fascinating.
A lot of action, yeah.
A lot of action. And again, yes, to Bulgaria, a lot of our listeners will remember from previous seasons of our podcast the amount of Bulgarian elections there have been. And there's going to be yet another one relatively soon. So the president of Bulgaria, Roman Radev, who's officially an independent but has a background in the Socialist Party, has called for snap elections to take place in Bulgaria for the parliament on June 6th, so in conjunction with the European elections. And this comes after the incumbent power-sharing government in the country collapsed. So just for context, this will be the sixth general elections there since 2021. That's crazy. Radev, as part of this decision, has appointed a new caretaker government as well, headed by a man called Dimitar Glachev, who is more of a bureaucrat and the head of the Bulgarian National Audit Office. So just for some background, the current government that has now collapsed was created in May last year, following the last snap election the month before that. So in short, it's basically two parties or coalitions. So one's led by GERB, which is a center-right party that sits with the European People's Party at the European level, and the other one led by DPS, which is more sort of center, big tent coalition. So it has some parties belonging to the liberal group, some Greens, but also some more socially liberal center-right politicians. They agreed last year in a form of power-sharing agreement. So what that entailed was that the two parties agreed that Denkov would become prime minister for 9 months, while a woman called Maria Gabriel would become the deputy prime minister, and then they would switch their roles every 9 months. So Denkov being the sort of more left-wing option, and then Gabriel being the more right-wing one. So this was all fine and great for the first 9 months, but then as soon as it came to the first transition, that's when it already collapsed. So what happened was that Gabriel was due to swap with Denkov, but there was debate around the different positions that the politicians would have as part of this arrangement, and also how long her term would be. So basically, they started to try and have renegotiations, but when it didn't go her way, Gabriel decided to withdraw her nomination to the post, which led to the whole thing just falling apart. This all started in April 2021, this chaos, when the incumbent government at the time, led by Prime Minister Borisov, who's from the center-right GERB party, failed to form a government. And then that sort of set into motion this sort of perennial difficulty facing the country. In terms of the legacy of Denkov, a lot of his focus has been on trying to gain energy independence for Bulgaria, which is very reliant on Russian export of oil and gas. And also a lot of the focus for campaigners and politicians in Bulgaria is the issue of corruption. You can just imagine, having all of this chaos, this negotiation for roles, this messiness of administration in a country that has an issue with corruption as well. It's really not that pretty. And I'm sure for people in Bulgarian politics, it must be an extremely frustrating and exhausting existence. So while obviously at Europelect we're partial to opinion polling and elections, I'm not jealous of whoever has to administer those time after time. I don't know what you think about that, Javid. It's quite unique.
Well, yeah, but I'm not sure actually, because there's no way they can create the coalition, a sustainable one, because they have they're too different from each other. I mean, you have the Social Democrats who are becoming less and less popular, GERB that dominated, and then this new PP and DB coalition that is led by these Harvard graduates who are trying to reform the country from top to bottom. So it's complicated, to be honest. But on the other hand, also, it's unfortunate to see that the hardship of creating coalitions is proliferating from Balkans or from Eastern Europe also to the Western Europe. For example, just like in Portugal that we've just discussed. It's becoming tougher and tougher to create sustainable coalitions in a multi-party democracy, at least in the European context.
I guess a good example of where similar was Ireland that we mentioned, because I believe that Varadkar had a similar agreement with the Liberal Party in Ireland, where he switched his position as prime minister like every 2 years with another politician. But I guess in Ireland it worked, in Bulgaria it failed, and then in Portugal we'll have to wait and see. But you're right that no country can avoid the difficulties with the coalition. So that's already a lot of things covered, but we have also very important ongoing election campaigns in Spain, Javid.
Well, yeah, some final remarks. So tomorrow, the Basque electorate is going to elect its regional Basque parliament. The parliament consists of 75 seats, and 38 is needed for a majority. The Spanish-speaking left parties, Sumar and Podemos, they will be battling out for the relevance and the chance to stay in the parliament. On the other hand, Vox is also set to leave the parliament altogether as it struggles with a medium-term decline at the national level. The two mainstream Spanish parties, Partido Popular and PSOE, they set to remain as they are. But the former bigger parties of Spain, Ciudadanos, the centrists, they broke their alliance with the PP, meaning that the Spanish-speaking liberals are unlikely to return to the parliament. But the main take from here, so in Basque County, there are two local Basque parties. One is called the Basque Nationalist Party, which is a centrist and traditionally the most popular Basque party. And the second one is Euskal Herria Bildu, which means Basque County Gather. So it is left-wing to far-left, but more and more moderate, more and more simply left-wing political party that is traced back with its origin and connected, historically speaking, to some elements of Euskadi Askatasuna, ETA, which used to be a separatist terrorist movement. So over the last decades, while ETA became defunct in 2011. So this party was created in 2011 as well. So gradually, while it was considered a fringe at the beginning, they gradually started to moderate and to build a more coherent political party program, etc. So they're especially popular among the young population and among the leftist population. And for the first time, it is expected that they may actually become the biggest party in the parliament. And they usually support the Basque independence. But even then, in their political campaign, they try to moderate on that as well. In general, this trend of EH Bildu, this party, somewhat reminisces me of Sinn Féin in Ireland, which was also a fringe initially, but then gradually they became moderate. They're also popular among the left-wing voters, among the young voters, etc. So it's really interesting to see this parallel in Europe. IRA and ETA, they have some parallels in that regard as well. So they defunct their military wings and they cease to involve into terroristic action, etc. And gradually, the political parties that were originated from these movements were able to transform themselves into a moderate left-wing, supported by the young, this kind of like major political forces. They were transforming themselves into like major political forces over the last decade or so. It's really fascinating to see. I'm actually really curious whether there are some scholarly articles on this issue.
It is, I guess, from their perspective, a feat to be able to make that change, especially in the public perception. Yeah, I mean, I guess you could draw similar parallels to the sort of far right as well, and how some of those movements have managed to go from fringe, violent street gangs to sort of slowly becoming seen by the public as viable solutions. Like, there'll be a lot of politicians that we see today and that will come into the European Parliament in a few months that would not want to share exactly what they were up to in the 1990s. I shouldn't really laugh because a lot of it is quite violent, but I think you're right that it is an interesting trend. Finally, there'll also be elections in Catalonia, which obviously has, you know, as a economically and politically very significant region of Spain, always has large implications on, you know, national politics there and then also European politics. In terms of what's expected to happen, it can probably be seen as sort of the final nail in the coffin for the liberal Ciudadanos party in Spain. Catalonia has been sort of their final bastion of relevance and as the platform that they were planning to use ahead of the EU election. But it looks like they're going to fail to keep any presence in the parliament there, despite trying, you know, quite populist, quite aggressive campaigns targeting Charles Puigdemont, the Junts candidate and leader who's pro-independence, and taking this very sort of nationalist stance. Seems like it's not going to work for them. It also looks like the ERC are expected to suffer losses to Junts that I mentioned and the PSC, but still they'll be essential to form whatever the next government will be. It's also believed that the Sumar and the centre-left will lose ground to these parties, particularly in light of Ciudadanos. The centre-right Partido Popular will also see some gains in terms of its share of the vote. It's also managing to outflank Vox, the far-right party in Spain, who since last year has sort of had a steady decline at the national level, sort of from being up, you know, 25% in the polls, like down to 10 to 15%. A lot of that is to the benefit of Pepe, so they'll see an impact of that. So they can probably spin it in terms of their national campaigning too. There are some new parties trying to shake things up. One is called Alianza Catalana, which is sort of far-right fringe outfit. They could gain a seat in Girona, which is in Catalonia. There is also a party called Alora, sorry for the pronunciation, but they're a more big tent Catalan nationalist party set up by a politician called Clara Ponsati, who used to previously be elected for Junts and is an incumbent MEP in Brussels. So she is trying to take up some space from some former nationalist parties there as well. You know, overall, the elections in Catalonia and also in the Basque country that you spoke about, Javed, they are, you know, going to have a big impact as Spain heads into the campaign for the EU elections. There is platforms, for example, like Ahora Repúblicas, which contain both the ERC from Catalonia, but also Bildu that you mentioned. And they're going to obviously try together to get as much of a vote share as possible. Junts as well, despite, you know, running alone, they'll be hoping to get some seats. So they'll all be trying to use this as a springboard to that, so to speak. And then obviously it does matter in both cases, the relation between PSOE, the center-left party of government in Spain, and the PP as well. So worth keeping an eye on and reading into both those elections. I think this sums up everything that's going on, David. It's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. But I mean, we're going towards the summer, a lot of electoral action usually in spring, so...
That's true. And then obviously the sort of crescendo will be the EU Parliament elections. And obviously that's the sort of peak of activity for Europe Elects overall. We'll all be super busy. There'll obviously be more from us at the Europe Elects podcast covering that. So we'll keep everyone posted on details closer to the time. But yeah, it's not looking to slow down anytime soon. So that's super exciting. Thank you, David, for doing the podcast with me, and speak soon.
Thank you for doing podcast with me. It's a pleasure.
Of course.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Europe Elects podcast, which is hosted by me, Gabriel Hedengren, and Javid Ibad. Our producer and audio engineers were Leonardo Basso and Joao Reis. The script was written by our hosts and our writing team, Eric Balonwu and Thomas Stokes. The music was by Jose Alvarado, and everything we do would be impossible without our patrons on Patreon, so thank you very much. Please do follow us to stay up to date with European politics. You find us across every social media platform you can imagine, but mainly Twitter/X, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can also find us online at europeelects.eu, and at europeelects is the way to find us on all those social media accounts except for Instagram, at which we are at Europe_elects. Also, if you have any ideas for segments, any thoughts on topics we should be covering, or if you just want to say hi, shoot us an email at podcast@europeelects.eu. Thank you all so much again, and see you next time.